The following recording by the LA Sound Posse is a lecture given by Dr. Ira Sohn on June 18th of 2004 in Santa Monica, California. The talk was sponsored by the Southern California Federation of Scientists and the Monthly Review Discussion Group. The lecture was titled, The Materialist Conception of History. Dr. Sohn holds degrees in physics and economics and currently teaches economics at universities both in the U.S. and China. The complete talk has been divided into three parts, and this is part three, which contains the question and answer session.
That's been long. You're probably weary.
No. If people have questions, be delighted to entertain any questions you have. Yes.
Yeah. What is the whole idea of his trip to Paris? Say, like the for example, the Paris transcriptions. What's that? Is his response of the.
Paris transcriptions.
Well, he called himself a communist because, the question is, what was Marx's connection with things that happened in Paris? Actually, they're happening in Marseille and a bunch of other cities in France, but the revolution in France really was concentrated in Paris. And it erupted in 1789, and there were many different groups involved, which finally started murdering one another off, because what they were really fighting about was the question of who's going to be the new ruling class. And there were different sections of capitalists who wanted that honor, but there were also groups of workers, many of them very skilled workers. They weren't really unskilled wage laborers. They were almost artisans, and they were very well organized, and they were literate. And they organized something called the commune, which said there shall be no private property, and we do not want to submit to capitalists after having submitted the centuries to feudal aristocrats. We want basically a democratic society. And they were under assault from eventually people like Napoleon, but even before Napoleon, there were organized police forces of a kind that attacked the commune. And so they said, we have no choice but to pick up weapons and defend ourselves. And because they believed in armed struggle to establish an egalitarian society, Marx said, I am a communist. I do not believe in utopian socialism. I don't think that noble examples are going to change the minds of capitalists. I honor them. Because he was almost the only one, his group, the Communist Party of Germany at the time, was almost the only one who really believed in overt class struggle involving arms. The rest wanted reforms of different kinds.
Yeah, that's true, especially with, I'm sorry to go beyond, but especially...
No, it's okay.
Especially during, say, like in 1850, well, during the time the Communist Manifesto...
1848,
was written,
yeah.
It was, say, like in the heat of the...
Yes.
The whole uprising.
Right.
Countries in Europe. And of
course,
Haiti had theirs.
Oh, yeah. Toussaint Louverture's uprising was an armed struggle that defeated France.
Yeah, that's right.
Like it had never been defeated before. So, again, Marx had examples of armed struggle, not just the Communards, but the Haitian struggle and other uprisings all over the world, really. But he was convinced that people who were exploiters were not just going to say, okay, it'll be nice to have socialism or nice to have democracy. They were already attacking groups, like the Chartist movement came long before Marx's time, and it was brutally assaulted by the British police and the British army. And their demands were really mild, like a 12-hour workday and a minimum wage, and especially the abolition of child labor. And by our standards, it was nothing, but by the standards of the British ruling class, it was really threatening, and they suppressed the Chartists brutally. And there were peasants being badly oppressed by the police and army in Germany. He wrote it on behalf of them. And, of course, he made himself very unpopular in country after country. So after 1848, or even before, he was kind of always on the run. And finally, he settled in England, probably because the working class in England had been pacified by steady wage raises and were not militant. So the British ruling class figured, oh, well, we got a lot of people like Marx. We really don't have much to worry about. But he would have been arrested and maybe executed had he chosen to remain on the continent. In fact, many people from his group came to the United States, seeking refuge. Yes.
First of all, thank you, Ira. Very refreshing to sit and listen to a very organized, lucid presentation.
You're welcome.
On an important issue. I mean, I've been studying this for more than half my life. I've taught courses. I've been in hundreds of conferences, and this was a wonderful presentation. I have a comradely disagreement, but first,
you're allowed.
You're thinking of some of Byron and Shelley's poetry written in the early 19th century, especially around the time of the rise of the Luddite struggle.
Right, right.
And of course, the lines, a couple of them in Shelley's poem, rise like lions after slumber.
Yes.
We are many, they are few.
Right.
the tragedy, of course, as with Keats, they all died at a very young age. Who knows what they would have written. For those, by the way, who think Ira's comments on the issue of abstract expressionism is off the wall, there's a wonderful book by Francis Saunders Stoner.
Really?
Stoner Saunders on the Congress of Cultural Freedom in the 50s and 60s.
The CIA front.
CIA, and it's marvelous, it's historically documented. My comradely disagreement is, I think, should have a little more of a Marxist scientific analysis of Noam Chomsky's position. He would agree with Lincoln. He's argued in his works, he's argued in public, that it has been public awareness that's broken through the manufacturing consent mm-hmm. that actually makes the United States today a better society than it was in the 50s, and there was actually much more consciousness and awareness against the Iraqi war than at a similar point in the early development of the Vietnam War.
Okay.
So that would be my...
All right, well, I've read a bunch of his works, and he operates from a moral standpoint. He exposes, you know, monstrous things that the United States has done. And yeah, it has done those things, and it tries to deceive the American people and other people about it. But that's not Marx's point of view. Marx's point of view is that this system has to be abolished for material reasons, whatever one's moral point of view. Marx thought that it was a pretty monstrous system, obviously, but that was not his line of attack. Now, another criticism to which Chomsky has always been subjected, and I don't know that he's ever answered it, maybe you know, he never says what people should do exactly or what would emerge from, I assume he would like a broad movement. What's going to happen? Could capitalism be made humane? From Noam Chomsky's point of view?
No.
I read three or four.
He's not.
Sort of define himself as a pacifist, anarchist, something like that.
Socialist. Yeah.
Socialist. But it's like a doctor saying, well, you're sick with X disease, but then you say, well, you know, what do I do about that? And he's kind of silent on that question. And I think it's important. I think the reason Marx is popular all over the world is that he said what should be done. Now, maybe people interpreted him in strange ways that he would object to. At the end of his life, he said, I'm not a Marxist, because of everybody who was claiming to be a Marxist. But I think that's sort of an obligation or something. You don't just point out what's wrong and say, okay, this is wrong, and then what? Because people listen to him. Thousands of people listen to him. If he said, I think that the next step should be X, they might not agree, they might agree, but it would be on the agenda. People could think about it, but he's not putting it on an agenda.
Well, maybe we could talk about some other people.
Right,
but
right.
Thank you again.
Okay.
I really appreciate it.
I don't know who.
Good
point.
Okay. Yeah. A couple of questions.
Yes.
First of all, I echo what he said, that the real tour de force.
Thank
for
you.
For one night, you cover an awful lot.
Wow.
But I'm wondering, what's your take on the so-called socialist experiments of a 20th century, Soviet Union?
Well, I don't think they were socialist. I'm sorry.
But your take on that in terms of how they have developed, evolved, or devolved, and in that regard, mentioning China, what's the rationale by the Chinese, or how would you see it in terms of a transition from their doing primitive accumulation of capitalism onto some future socialism? Or is there any sense at all of this in their thinking or in your thinking?
Well, they call themselves Marxists, but they won't let me teach Marxism at the Beijing Communist Party School or any other party school. And their version of Marxism is not quite mine, and I don't want to raise the issue because they'll put me on the next plane out. And I value my experiences in China. It enables me to understand China, and I talk about subjects that are not going to ruffle their feathers. I don't know of any other American that they're sending all over the country, unmonitored, to say anything he likes. They don't censor me. Sometimes they attend my lectures, they like them. But they don't know what I'm going to say, and I'm not going to say anything that would obviously, first of all, ruin their careers, possibly, and then get me booted out of the country permanently.
Some of us from aerospace have had a similar experience in this country.
Yeah, well, you know. Now, to answer your question, well, I don't think that these societies are socialist. I don't think that they were ever socialist. Marx's ideas were used by various political groups to mobilize people behind themselves. Just as the people who conducted the Inquisition used some of Christ's ideas. Now, Christ was not responsible for the Inquisition. In my opinion, nothing he ever said would justify, you know, what went on. In my opinion, nothing Marx ever said would justify, you know, what Lenin, never mind Stalin, what Lenin did, what Trotsky did. I mean, they were busy machine-gunning workers in Kronstadt who wanted the real democracy. I don't think that there was ever socialism in China, but it's convenient. Some of Marx's ideas are convenient as an ideology for these people to use to justify their rule. Now, the Soviet Union has collapsed, and China is obviously making the transition to capitalism. There's just no mistake about it. And Deng Xiaoping made the definitive remark. He said, it doesn't matter if a cat is white or black, as long as it catches mice. In other words, we'll introduce the market system in all its glory. We'll control the thing if we can. And that's just it. And we'll call it socialism with Chinese characteristics. But you know, George Bush says he's interested in democracy. I don't think he's interested in democracy. I don't think that the Chinese leaders are or have ever been interested in socialism. They like ruling.
In that case, a more provocative follow-up, how
yes.
can you speak of the science of Marxism and some of the leading Marxists, ostensibly
well,
in the last century, have produced this kind of caricature?
I have my opinion of Marxism, and they have theirs. I think mine is correct. Maybe they think theirs is correct, or maybe they realize it's ridiculous, but it serves to manipulate hundreds of millions of people.
But do you think the word science is really applicable?
Marx did. He called what his form of socialism scientific socialism.
But do you think that that's accurate?
Yes, I do.
You do?
Yes.
That's another discussion. Remember?
Well, yeah. Where? I don't have a crystal ball. I don't know. It sort of depends on what happens to the economy. If the economy recovers and the standard of living returns to where it was maybe 10 years ago, I would say the U.S. will continue to drift in a kind of conservative direction. If the economy not tanks exactly, you know, things get worse and worse, then I think labor will become more militant. I think college students are going to be more and more worried about getting any kind of a job, and they're going to be interested in Marx's ideas or revolutionary ideas, and that the society generally will turn in a leftward direction. That's, you know, it's based on my understanding of how society operates. But no one knows where the U.S. economy or the world economy is going to be a year from now. I believe China is going to boom for a long time. I believe India is going to boom for a long time. I think South America is starting to coalesce into one free trade area and ally itself with India and China and Europe, and I think it's going to make a lot of economic progress. But the United States, I think, is on the decline with respect to its ability to determine the world's economic affairs. And that's why it's sending troops everywhere, not just Iraq. It's sending them all over Africa, because Africa has about 8% of the world's oil, so far as we know, probably has a lot more. And right now, the United States is getting 15% of its oil from Africa. In a decade, it's going to be getting 25% of its oil from Africa. So it's trying to establish military bases in Africa and also in Central Asia to prop up hated regimes that happen to be sitting on a lot of oil and natural gas. So what it's doing by military means is what it can no longer do by economic means, which of course bankrupts the society. The Roman Empire fell for the same reason. It was so busy fighting off the barbarians that it destroyed its own economy. Many empires have collapsed for that reason. So the question you've asked is a very difficult one. This is my provisional... Excuse me? The project for the new American century? Yeah, well, it's the right wing, which has been given a mandate for the moment to make U.S. foreign policy, and it reflects the desperation, in my opinion, of the U.S. ruling class. But I used to be able to do by economic and political means a lot. It sent the Marines out only in extreme cases. Now it's sending them out everywhere. And I don't think it can maintain this kind of momentum. It already says it's stretched thin because of Iraq. Well, you know, how is it going to be able to send 50,000 troops, let's say, to Nigeria because there's an uprising against the ruling class that really depends on U.S. support? What about Kazakhstan? I mean, all these places, they're involved in civil wars and warlordism. I don't think the U.S. can really do it militarily, but maybe I'm wrong.
Go ahead.
I want to rise to the occasion by saying I was named after Karl Marx.
Okay.
And my father was a minister who became a communist.
Mm-hmm.
So a question for you is, if the world is now almost totally capitalistic, what is the change of production, the means of production, that will throw off this capitalist system?
Well, first of all, there are 310 million people in China who have cell phones now. and maybe 80 million who are plugged into the internet. More and more people in China are becoming more and more aware of what's going on in the larger world, and they're communicating more and more with one another. Now, more and more people are also getting jobs in factories. The wages are miserable, but at least they're eating, which is something they weren't doing as farmers. So it's going to be a while before the rate of unemployment in China goes down, and workers can become more militant. If every worker in a factory who's deeply oppressed knows that there are 50 people in the employment office willing to take his job, he's going to be a little reluctant to do anything in the way of organization because he'll be fired and his family will starve to death. So it's going to take a lot more industrialization of China before you have a militant working class. And the same thing is true in India. And meanwhile, the standard of living of the American people is still pretty high. And I think people in America are hoping that somehow magically Kerry or Bush or someone can turn things around. Until they become convinced there ain't going to be no turnaround, they're not going to become militant. In the 1930s, there were about 1 million Americans at one time or another who were members of the Communist Party. Now, it wasn't very militant, but, you know, it stood for something. When the world's working class will have its back literally against the wall because production is grinding to a halt, I just don't know. I mean, every day there are new technologies of communication and materials technologies being invented, and I don't understand when that will imperil the existence of the capitalist ruling class. Maybe it'll be by a different group, pollution. Maybe the world will just be strangling on these wastes. I don't know how the Olympics will be held in Beijing in 2008 because athletes will refuse to engage in sprints. I mean, it is worse than anything I've seen in the United States. I could go on at great length about the pollution in Beijing and every other Chinese city. Now, at some point, maybe pollution will drive people to revolt. They'll just say, well, we can't take it anymore. Our children are dying. I have emphysema. I don't know. I don't know of anyone else who knows.
It was a long time ago, like 20 years ago, not long after the rise of Deng Xiaoping.
Yeah.
I went to China with the U.S. People's China, U.S.
Right, right. Friendship
People's
Committee.
Friendship,
right, right. I knew many people who
were. And we got to talk to some high officials. You know, have dinners. We always had one dinner with a very high official.
Right.
And the one high official, I don't remember what he was, but I was the only Marxist in the group.
That must have made him uncomfortable.
And I was always coming up with embarrassing questions.
Yes.
He wanted to convince the rest of the people there that he was capitalist. And they were all reactionaries, most of them from Mississippi, and they wanted to believe that China was going capitalist. And so I asked him the question, isn't China going capitalist? And he didn't want to say, because their propaganda to the people was that China was Marxist.
Right.
But what he said was kind of interesting. He says, well, right now we're going capitalist because a single country that's communist cannot survive in a capitalist world.
Yeah.
And we are waiting for the world to...
Oh, I see.
...to its capitalist production.
I understand.
And even out over everything, and then we're going to have a world revolution, and then we got world communism all at once.
I see. Well, okay.
What can you tell us about... I've read a number of articles a few years ago about... Some people claim that Marx did have some ecological ideas or ideas about sustainable economy, and other people have argued that he just wasn't quite as contemporary in those ideas.
Well,
repeat the question.
Yeah, some people claim that Marx was concerned with ecological issues, and I've read a lot of Marx, not all. There's nowhere in it that he takes account of the environment, and obviously that's a pretty serious lapse. However, Engels wrote a very famous, excellent pamphlet called The Part Played by Labor in the Transition from Ape to Man. And in it, there's a big section devoted to the environment and on how human beings alter the environment, or have been for thousands of years, sometimes in a very negative way. Now, Engels was really ahead of his time. If you read that thing, it sounds like any contemporary environmentalist with a militant edge.
I think there's some passages where Marx does talk about nature, and it might imply from them that he understands that you have to take care of nature if you're going to...
It could be. First of all what he wrote has not been published. Most of what he wrote has not been published. And he could have written stuff that I'm not aware of, but I'm aware of his major works. And he says nature is what humans transform to their own purposes. And he explained industrialization as occurring in the temperate climates because he said, well, in the really Arctic and Antarctic climates, it's hard to grow anything. And in tropical climates, I don't know, it's somehow too easy, or it's only where you have temperate conditions where there's a certain amount of stress, but not too much, where industrialization begins, and I don't know that I would agree with that, but how was he supposed to know in his own day? Environmentalism didn't exist as a study. It really dates from the mid-60s.
Yes.
Two things. First of all, 1848, they called London the smokes because it was an accumulated population in a small area.
Right.
Everybody burning coal.
Right.
So Marx and Engels both lived in it and knew about the idea.
They certainly did, yeah.
The second thing is, you're an economist as well as a physicist, and do you have a handle on the possibility of a natural resource base providing the level of life of Germany or the United States for everybody included?
I think that with a democratic world, you could have an extremely high standard of living. However, people make use of resources. I don't know what they might do with all sorts of things that are now considered maybe waste products. I'm not that familiar, but I think the big impediment to a magnificent standard of living is not resources. It's the social system. So the problem is a political one. It's not a technological one. It's not a resource one. Beyond that, I'm not familiar enough to say, but the imagination of human beings is really great, and I'm sure they could figure out ways of producing energy that are sustainable, whether that means solar or wind or something, I don't know. But to blame people's suffering on a lack of oil is a misunderstanding. After all, who's getting the oil? Who's refining the oil? Who's using the oil for what purposes?
I'm not talking about at the moment. I'm talking about
in the future. In the future, I think we could have a utopian society if the world was controlled democratically. Without it being controlled democratically, you'll have misery, no matter what the degree of technological development. That's guaranteed. If I could have talked more about Volume 1 of Capital, you know, I could show, you know, why unemployment is always going to be here and why different sections of the working class will be paid different wages, and most of them just allowing them to teeter on the edge of existence.
Yes, we understand that, but in fact, if we do not have enough to feed everybody, there will be starvation, even if we have an egalitarian society.
Well, I believe an egalitarian society could feed everyone abundantly, and not with junk food, but, you know, good food. That's just my belief. Yes.
I grew up in a small factory town in upstate New York. Actually, Corning, New York, where Corning Glass was. And everybody, of course, everybody in our family worked there. Everybody in the neighborhood worked there.
A company town.
It was a company town. But the people there had a class consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
And they understood the relation between the owners of the factory and their own condition. And there were no illusions about that. And, of course, when the Roosevelt reforms happened, he became their hero.
Mm-hmm.
And they were waiting for something like that. And I'm comparing that. Something happened along the way. There was a little resurgence in the 60s of some kind of consciousness, not from my parents' generation, but from the younger people. But that has also sort of disappeared. What I see now is practically a total lack of consciousness on the part of the general population. It seems to be just sort of anesthetized.
I agree.
Yeah. Television by the Hollywood stuff and all that. Yeah. Do you see anything that's going to turn that around?
Yeah, as I said to the first question that was answered, should the standard of living of America collapse, militancy will rise. I'm a materialist. I think that as long as people can afford an SUV now and then and send their kids to college and get their teeth repaired correctly, they'll put up with a lot. I mean, you're talking about the 30s when a quarter of the people were unemployed, when there was starvation, when people were leaving the cities to grow vegetables in the countryside. It's not too hard to imagine people becoming militant then. But with the standard of living in America what it is now, it's hard to see. There's a psychological investment that many Americans have in the system. They want to see the recession end. They want to resume the life they had maybe 10 or 15 years ago. Maybe they're romanticizing a lot of it, but that's what their hope is. When they give up hope in the system, then you'll see the return of militancy. Not before then. It would be idealist to imagine that their minds would change. I kind of believed at the end of the 60s myself that maybe if the left were well enough organized, they got into communities, could reach ordinary people, it could transform things. But people tried, and it didn't work, not because they weren't dedicated, not because they weren't intelligent, but because the standard of living was what it was. I hate to be the bearer of this kind of news, but...
Well, I hate to be the bearer of other kinds of news. You know, it's 10 o'clock. You've been talking for like 2.5 hours here.
Yeah.
And
There was one question.
So anybody who has... some things after we're through, you know, I'm sure I
Yeah, I'll come up and just talk. Yeah, this gentleman.
You raised a question about when things get worse, that people will begin to mobilize and make changes.
Right.
We have, though, a period not too long ago when things got worse in Germany and people mobilized but did not mobilize to change things for the better.
Right, okay, they went in the direction of fascism. And what can I say? I mean, it could happen in America. I wish I had a crystal ball. I do not understand the rise of Nazism or fascism generally very well. It's a big question why, when the standard of living collapsed in certain places, Japan, Italy, Germany, Spain, Portugal, did people move in a rightward direction rather than a leftward direction? Now, I don't have the answer to that.
On the other hand, you say
all right, well,
that they moved in the leftward direction.
In America?
In Russia and later in,
yes.
In China. And yet you are critical of, you say that this was not socialism, and I think something has to be said about the relationship of the state in any
right. Well, in China, when the communists took over, they took over the state, the imperial state, the Kuomintang state, and they just used it for their own purposes, the way they used Marxism for their own purposes. But the Communist Party of China was never democratic, not from 1920 on, when it was founded.
Did not have history. So then the question raised as to whether or not socialism can be brought to a country that was feudal at a feudal stage.
Yeah, you're right.
And has to wait until it reaches
right.
the obsolescence of an industrial state.
It has to have an industrial proletariat. And China did not. And Russia did not.
And that's why they could not establish something.
Yeah, well, but, I mean, you have a bunch of leaders who were determined to rule. That was also part of it. Lenin, you know, had no illusions of what he wanted to happen in Russia should he be able to overthrow the Tsar.
But that's what Marxists have never really, at least in the United States, fully discussed the question of the role of the state. Under what society, the state is at best a necessary evil and must be guarded against dictatorship.
Well, I think in these countries, the so-called socialist movements were determined to rule no matter what the nature of the state. And even if the state in China and Russia had been shattered, whatever new one evolved would serve the interests of the new ruling class, which was a bunch of intellectuals who were determined to rule. And so there was nothing to oppose them. There was no industrial proletariat much, except St. Petersburg and Moscow. And in Kronstadt, they were machine-gunned by Trotsky. And why the U.S. left has not raised these issues, I think, has to do with the nature of the U.S. left to some extent. Who was in the U.S. left? What kinds of organizations
CIA
were they part
agents.
Of? Well, no, but I mean, I knew a lot about the U.S. left in the late 60s. Yeah. And there were people who had been in the Communist Party for decades. And there were Maoists, and there were Trotskyists and Stalinists. And they all subscribed to some theory of intellectuals being in charge once we can get rid of the capitalists. So maybe that accounts for the theoretical deficiencies that you take note of. They had their own material interests.
Mark say anything about this?
And they all became anti-communist.
Not really. I mean, he was part of a party. He wrote the Communist Manifesto for the party. But he never said much about the role of intellectuals, except they should be helping the working class.
Nobody.
Or the structure of the government.
No. He wrote maybe three or four paragraphs on what socialism would be like in something called the Critique of the Gotha Program. And he wrote thousands of pages. So he said it would be futile to speculate on.
It's like Buddha and Jesus. Everybody is all the different disciples form all these.
Oh, yeah. Once they're dead, it's very easy to. Bob, yes.
We're going to prove that Marx kind of eschewed the whole idea of a party for communists anyway. He did not regard the communist movement as another party. Not really another party.
He was vague. I mean, he just felt that his organization, its role would be to help the working class get power. Yeah, not that he never said the party should take over and rule. He talked about the dictatorship of the proletariat. He meant the real dictatorship of workers. He didn't mean the dictatorship of Lenin or Mao.
It's clear that Russia, China did not follow Marx.
Yes, but they would say the conditions in our societies were quite different from those in Europe, where you have a large, well-developed working class, people are literate, you can have something like even vaguely like democracy in places like Western Europe and the U.S. Lenin said, well, we have to operate secretly because the Tsar's secret police are out to kill us or send us to Siberia. How do you expect us to have votes? And once he took power, he said, well, all the capitalists are sending their armies in to overthrow this. What do you want us to do, have infinite congresses, you know, to allow all the workers to vote? I mean, he always had a reason for why the rule of the party was the rule of the proletariat.
Why would that not be a deficiency of Marx's scientific...
Marx really refrained from saying almost anything about what a socialist society would be like. He said, it's impossible to know. He said, well, I mean, he was assuming that the workers would take power and in some way control the society. He said leadership, insofar as it was necessary, should rotate. He said there should be complete transparency. He believed in what we would call democracy. Obviously, that was not what happened in Russia and China. And the leaders acknowledged that, and they just said, well, conditions are different. The capitalists are still much more powerful than we are. If we have true democracy, they're going to overthrow us. The CIA will send in its spies. There'll be assassins. So when we're developed enough and strong enough, then we can cede power to the working class. But meanwhile, we represent them. We are the dictatorship of the proletariat. I don't think they are, but some people think they...
I think we ought to let Ira go. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Okay.
That's really great.
Thank you.
And I want to thank you all for coming.
You have been listening to Dr. Ira Sohn's lecture titled The Materialist Conception of History. This completes part 3 of the full 3-part program. It was recorded on June 18th of 2004 in Santa Monica, California. The talk was sponsored by the Southern California Federation of Scientists and the Monthly Review Discussion Group. Dr. Sohn holds degrees in physics and economics and currently teaches economics at universities both in the U.S. and China. This program was produced by the L.A. Sound Posse. The L.A. Sound Posse records speeches and events dealing with social justice issues. We anti-copyright these recordings and share them via the Internet, via community radio, and CDs distributed through grassroots social justice groups, nonprofit organizations, committed individuals, and others. Our goal is to be a part of the creation of a broad-based, participatory, and democratic civic media in support of the creation of a truly democratic society. You can reach us on the web at www.lasoundposse.org. Contact us for copies of this program on CD. You can download it for free at radioforall.net. That's www.radio4all.net. If you value what you heard on this program, please feel free to copy and distribute it to others who you think would benefit from hearing it, and thus becoming yourself a part of a decentralized, democratic, civic media.